with that, I'm going to turn the floor over to Joe Cozzopoli and the technical panel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Return to flight milestones that NASA has established is now occurring. They're planning to move the tank, external tank, to the Cape by the end of this month, and all the major elements will be at the Cape going through their launch preparations. We're seeing the external tank being, and Dick Coors is going to go through to a lot of details of this, but there's a tremendous amount of progress been made to the tank. The orbiter, there's been a lot of work, a lot of redesign, and the implementation of that redesign has been accomplished. You're going to hear a little bit from Dr. Daniels about the solid rocket booster bolt catcher and the completion of those activities. So it's enlightening to us to see that the milestones that NASA has established to return to flight are happening. I want to thank those. We can't do it without the help of all of you attending our meetings with us and also telecons. We appreciate the ops panel and the management panel. We appreciate you, Dick, of coming to witnessing all the activities at Michoud, watching that tank come together, and we all appreciate that. Now, we're going to probably have a lot more detail in these charts than you all can want to handle, but you sure can take a lot of breaks as we go through all this. We have six recommendations, CABE recommendations. Today you're going to hear that we are going to fully close two, and you're going to get status on the other four. There's one more, that's 331. We hope to have that all fully closed by January. So the other ones, like was mentioned, the external tank, that's going to take a while, and Dick Coors will take you through that. The orbiter hardening, Cy Rubenstein will give you a complete rundown there. And then finally, on TPS, Dr. Daniels and Kathy will give you a status of that one. That's the one that's dragging behind of all the other ones. But we'll show you what we got. Next chart, please. So with that, we'll get into the solid rocket booster bolt catcher, and Dr. Daniels has been heading this up, and he's got his presentation.
Thank you very much, Joe. A bit of the history on this. Next chart, please. This is an item which came up during the post-107 investigation. It was not found to be a contributor to the accident itself, but it was found to be a design deficiency and a qualification deficiency associated with the bolt catcher. The purpose of the bolt catcher is to absorb the energy and retain the fragments from the frangible bolt that holds the SRB to the external tank, which is a large pyrotechnic bolt. That severs at separation. This device, when was looked at in the post-107 environment, was found not to have the adequate factor of safety required. And the action coming off of the CABE was to go off and redesign and test and qualify the bolt catcher to a new design. The project did exactly that. They fully embraced the requirement to go back to totally redesign this activity, and I think as you'll see, that's exactly what they've done. Next chart, please. A few of the things that they've done associated with this redesign, they've gone off and changed the basic parent material of the bell housing, which is the large container that retains the separation bolt fragments and also contains the attenuation mechanism to attenuate the energy associated with the ejection of the bolt. They changed the basic material of that to a stronger and a thicker material. They changed the design from a two-piece welded design to a one-piece forged design. They also changed the TPS from a sprayed-on TPS to a stronger TPS, which was a machine cork, which was then bonded on and closed out with a Hypalon paint. They also increased the size of the retaining bolts, which hold the bell housing to its place on the external tank and the associated inserts that mate with those retaining bolts. They also changed the absorbing material in the bell housing itself to provide for a better attenuation association so there was less load transmissibility to the bell housing itself. And they addressed a problem that they had seen associated with the NASA standard initiator, which is the device which is used to initiate the ordnance sequence on the bolt itself. This was to eliminate an injection phenomenon which they had seen, not every time the bolt was fired, but on a number of occasions. Next chart, please. They also went off to address an issue which had been pointed out both by the CABE and also by the IG having to do with the inspection on the bolt, the SRB separation bolt and the various portions thereof, and that had to do with some government mandatory inspection reports which had been overridden by the delegated agency. They went back and looked at every government mandatory inspection point and then reestablished those delegations associated with this. The required factor of safety prior to 107 on this device had been 1.4, and the device was found not to demonstrate a 1.4 factor of safety. At the end of the activity, the calculated factor of safety supported by tests, both development and qualification tests, was found to be a structure factor of safety of 1.86 minimum. There are parts of it which are quite a bit more than that. Next chart, please. This gives you an idea of what the assembly is. The separation bolt is a large pyrotechnic bolt which consists of a machined metal body in which houses two pistons with an ordnance charge on either end of it and an NSI detonator screwed into either end of the bolt. The bolt will operate with only one ordnance charge and one NSI detonator firing. And what happens is these two large pistons inside the bolt react against each other, producing a situation which severs the bolt at the center line in a tension manner. When it does that, there's energy imparted to each segment, each half of the bolt. And that the purpose of the bolt catcher then is to retain that one half of the bolt so that it does not become a debris source. And the issue that was going to be addressed here was to showing that in retaining that energy associated with that, the bell housing for the bolt catcher and the TPS on the bolt catcher bell housing did not become a debris source in and of itself. Next chart, please. This shows the 107 bolt catcher and the new design bolt catcher and kind of summarizes what they've done. Starting from the outside and going in, originally they had a slow 561 sprayed on TPS. They have gone to a machine cork TPS. This is a cork that they had used in other applications on the SRB previously, but not in this application. It is machined in sections, bonded on, and then there's a Hypalon paint that's put over and above that as a weather coating. It's an environmental coating. Walking down from that, they had a two-piece design made of 2219 aluminum in which there was a bell housing and then the base was welded to the bell housing. They went to a one-piece forged design which is twice as thick and made out of a stronger material, 7051 aluminum. Going one step further down, inside of the bell housing, they had a spiral round energy absorber, which had a crush strength of 1,400 PSI. They replaced that with an aluminum honeycomb 52 energy absorber with a crush strength of 828 pounds. The reason they're going to the lower crush strength is because the purpose of this thing is to crush and absorb the energy. The more dense the material, the more energy it takes to crush this thing, the less energy it's going to absorb. Taking one more step down, we go to the fasteners. They doubled the size of the fasteners. They went to a stronger material. And then down at the bottom end of the bolt catcher, they had a double O-ring separate piece of material. They incorporated that into the single housing and went to a single O-ring. This is an environmental seal. And as a part of their development activity, they actually fired bolts with the O-ring out, and it passed the qualification. Next chart, please. This shows the way in which the NSI, the NASA Standard Initiator, was installed into the head of the bolt. The yellow item you see is the NSI. This is a standard ordnance detonating device which is used throughout NASA. The material it detonates is an ordnance charge inside of the bolt housing. It then reacts on the pistons, which you can see in the orange and the, I guess you would call it purple material. I'm not really sure what color that would be. Those two react together. They then produce a tension effect that causes the notch in the bolt to sever, separating the two halves of the bolt. The problem which had occurred was the energy associated with the detonation and the rebound effect of the piston and the ordnance charge had on occasion ejected the NSI into the attenuating mechanism. While this had not resulted in a failure, it did crush the energy absorber prior to the bolt and therefore had an effect upon the efficiency of the energy absorber. So the objective here was to eliminate this problem. Next slide, please. This is the way they went about that. They did not affect the NSI in any way. There was no change to the NSI. It is still screwed into the top of the separation bolt. But they added a retaining washer, and on top of that retaining washer, they added a retaining cap, which was a threaded cap, which mated with threads in the body of the housing, of the body cartridge, to retain the NSI in the event that it was attempted to be ejected. They then went off to look at how to qualify this device, and I'll give you some idea of how they went about qualifying this device in a moment. Next chart, please. They did a very classical form of design activity here. They went off to redefine the entire environment associated with the way in which this device operated. That is, what was the maximum ejection velocity that could possibly be seen? So what they went to was a 3 sigma plus ejection velocity that they won. Calculated analytically, and then they confirmed in test, in development test. So they established the maximum ejection velocity, and then associated with that, a energy profile for what could be transmitted to the bell housing and what would be reacted by the attachment bolts. They analytically calculated that, then they confirmed it with instrumentation on the bell housings during active bolt ejections, both ordnance-driven and also manual drop test to simulate the worst case possible ejection environment. So they established what their environment was that they then had to design their vehicle, their bolt catcher against, so that they would have the limits of their environments for their qualification purposes. What they then went in to do was to look at how they could possibly deal with the NSI device in terms of the qualification for it. They ran hydrostatic burst test, in which they applied a hydrostatic pressure against the retaining cap to see what the limits of that material were. They ran simulated pin ejection test into the low energy attenuator to see what the effects of these pin ejections would be over and above the ejections associated with the NSI itself, which they had eliminated. This was an effect where, although the NSI was retained, the pins that were inside the NSI might be ejected out, again through the phenomenon of energy being transmitted through the body of the NSI. That's an ordnance device.
Classically, on an ordnance device, the way in which we qualify those things is we fire 115% overcharge in the ordnance device and show that the structure will retain that. They did that. They fired 115% overcharge, but they could not analytically then show what the factor of safety was on the structure. So they went off to try and raise the bar and determine a way in which they could do this. They successively decided to assume that there was a linear relationship between the material properties on this and the strength of the factor of safety being demonstrated. So they removed material from the cap itself and proceeded to successive layers of tests until they got a failure. That factor of safety was shown to be somewhere between 2.3 and 2.6 and occurred with a yielding of the threads on the retention cap. So they established that they had a minimum of a 2.3 factor of safety on the NSI retention device in order to do this. Next chart. We have been involved in this process from the inception of the original PDR all the way through each one of the successive design reviews up to the level 4 DCR board, which occurred about 2 weeks ago. And we've tracked this thing. We've been involved in both the development test and the qualification test, which have occurred on the device. Next chart, please. We feel that they have fully met the mandate of the CABE recommendation in that they have a bolt catcher, which is a total redesign, demonstrates a structural factor of safety of a minimum of 1.86, has a thermal factor of safety of a minimum of 2, and that's minimum. Many of the other parts are far in advance of that. So we recommend full closure of this action.
Okay, questions or comments relative to the solid rocket booster bolt catcher?
I'll make one general comment, Mr. Chairman. Maintaining our independence, we do push back on a lot of this design and plans, and Dr. Daniels has been involved in this thing for 2 years, and they have listened to him quite well, and if it wasn't for him, I think we would still be struggling with this bolt catcher. And I think Marshall Space Flight Center gave me their comments of appreciations for his hard work.
Very good, and Dr. Daniels' particular contributions here, I think, mirror something that doesn't come out in a lot of our deliberations and meeting, which is the impact of our fact-finding activities in concert with the appropriate NASA program or other parts of the agency as they have proceeded to address the recommendations. That largely happens in the course of our fact-finding. It's integrated into the solutions that are brought forward. And so quite often, when we get to this point, most of our concerns have been addressed through the actions taken in response to our fact-finding, which has been substantial over the last 16 months, as I just kind of flipped through my mind thinking about when we started in August of 2003.
A long time ago.
And some would say in a galaxy far, far away. but that's an excellent point, Joe, and thank you, Chuck, for doing that. Okay, any other questions or comments on this particular recommendation? This is a little bit different than some of our other recommendations, which are largely driven by findings associated with cause or of the loss of the Columbia. This was found in the course of the investigation, was certainly a flight safety issue, found its way into a return to flight recommendation, and thus into our purview. But nevertheless, one that we have addressed And unless there's any other comments from the task group members or objections, I recommend that based on the closure package submitted by NASA, the technical panel's presentation, our deliberation, that the record reflect that the task group believes that NASA has met the intent of the CABE recommendation, and we accept the request for closure of CABE recommendation 4.2-1.
The next is a another closeout. This was brought to you all back in May. We had some conditions. The recommendation is it required at least two employees to attend all final closeouts of the inner tank area hand spraying procedures. Yesterday, Dick Coors showed you a video of the operations that took place on the tank. It was not exactly the inner tank area, but you notice there's more than two people looking at each one of these closeout areas. And that's why we showed you that video. The CABE also, there was some clarification that had to be done regarding the intent. Was it just supposed to be for the tank or the rest of the elements? And we decided that we would add the rest of the elements to this recommendation. This means the orbiter as well as the solid rocket boosters and other items. Next chart, please. NASA was to review and update the process controls. We have verified that the procedures you again saw in the video, the procedures that they were following, the critical areas, those are the closeout areas on a tank. You saw the people there. The MPPs, which is their detailed procedures, are written and signed off. There's government MIPS on right in the MPPs that have to be signed off by NASA. And then we have a letter that has been directed by the program office to the rest of the elements to implement this procedure. And I believe we have Bob that has Bob and General McCarthy has gone to the Cape and actually also witnessed the two-person closeouts there as well. Two-person closeout is not a new system. It's been around for a long time, and the CAPE has used it for many years, so it's in place. Next chart, please. So we have audited all the shuttle elements. We have they put the level requirements into the documentation. Again, we have audited it. We have received the documentation. We have the closeout package submitted to us. There's no open RFIs. There's nothing. We recommend full closure on this one as well.
Okay. Any comments relative to completion of the conditions on 4.2-3? If not, then unless there's a objection from a task group member, I recommend that based on the previously submitted closure package, technical panel's presentation today, that we reflect that the task group believes that NASA has met the intent of the CABE recommendation and accept their request for a closure of CABE recommendation 4.2-3.
Next chart, next recommendation, of course, is orbiter hardening, which Seibenstein's been following for the last past year or so. This will be a status, and there's been a considerable amount of progress, as you will see.
Thank you, Joe. This contains two primary parts. Can I get some more water?
Yes, sir.
Don't talk for an hour and the voice goes. One was to increase the orbiter's ability to sustain minor debris.
The second was to
determine the actual impact resistance of the orbiter to debris. This came about during the accident investigation. It was discovered that the primary requirements on the orbiter were handling requirements as opposed to debris impact requirement. And the only hard debris requirement was on the RCC due to on-orbit debris. And that was discovered more as a change that documented a capability as opposed to a design two requirement. Next chart. The interpretation of the actual implementation. So the program one initiated a program to increase the ability to sustain minor debris, and that really was understood that it would consist of near-term changes, ones that you can do right away, and that was initiated in parallel with all the analysis. Second is to have a part of those changes that can be done within a reasonable time frame, but also were not critical to return to flight. And then a third part of that change program would be long-term changes. And I'll go over that program in a brief summary. And then to do a detailed test and modeling activity to truly characterize the capabilities of the current system. And this was done in parallel with the activity on the hardware and in parallel with generating debris requirements. So the selection of the hardware changes were done by the experts who were reviewing the orbiter capability during the flight investigations. And then some of the testing actually showed some other areas that required improvement and pointed to another area that said they could defer any changes. And then by the time we got to first return to flight, these should be combined so we had a high confidence estimate of the impact resistance. Next chart. The activity started with the systems integration effort to define what's called critical debris, and that's been done and then interacted with the hardware elements to make sure that the system, that the debris that was being potentially generated could be sustained. And then the ET itself, which is the heart of all the things about the return to flight, has made significant changes, and Dick Kors will talk about that afterwards. The Orbiter Damage Impact Assessment Team developed capabilities for modeling the tile, which is a ceramic, and the RCC, which is a composite laminate, which didn't exist at the time they were built, and they're still undergoing final development today. Conducted large-scale full-panel testing of the RCC leading edge to make sure that we could define the energy level required to make a crack or a hole, and that was done in Southwest Research this summer. And then also coupon testing to characterize any models to make sure that the modeling was anchored in some substantial technical actual data. The testing program on the tile is essentially complete. Some follow-up tests are done now. The RCC testing program will be complete in February, and they'll all support the final model verification. The damage assessment to understand the likely effect of debris is in process, and that also requires a significant amount of modeling activity. And then as this goes along, this generates the requirements for what has to be repaired and not repaired. Next chart, please. As I indicated, NASA selected 15 hardware improvements in three phase groups, four of which I'll cover in some detail that will be implemented on the next flight. The overall plan was approved by the Orbiter Program Office. In the testing program, the side windows, of which they were slightly thinner, the thermal panes, and for those of you, just to remind you, the side windows, the orbiter windows have an outside temperature pane and then two inside panes mounted on the crew compartment, double redundant, that are pressure panes. So as the outside panes showed that the margin, the factor of safety was small enough that if you took some debris impact, there was a possibility, although quite small, that You could cause some kind of damage to it. And I'll cover that in a moment. The main landing gear testing. Well, there the concern was the barriers, so the thermal barriers around the door are non-redundant. And in the test program, it showed that the very low risk of any causing any kind of damage that would cause the tile to break and expose those thermal barriers. And those were then moved to the Group 2 list. And then there was also some forward-facing, or the Elevon Cove carrier plates, also shown to be a low-risk item. The RCC testing in this test program showed up a sensitivity that at the energy levels of the debris that could be defined as critical debris, recent tests show that that could generate a crack, a fairly small crack, which would be different than the kind of crack or hole that would be generated with a high energy impact. And that kind of crack would result in underlying layers being delaminated, and then if that occurred, you could actually burn through. And the levels of which this occurred are really in discussion now to understand what the real risk. It doesn't look like it's a risk to flight, but also it's still not clear what kind of repair might be required. The balance of this presentation I'll cover will talk about the orbiter hardening projects. Next chart. I won't go over the 15 charts. The ones I'll talk about are the four ones in blue. For reference, the two in green will be done after return to flight, and the ones in yellow are long-term. In this list, the yellow ones do include a tile improvement program, which was initiated, it's been in work for a couple of years now, which is coming to fruition on a time frame that'll be a long-term implementation, but it's coming to capability now so that replacement tiles could become available in phase two, and the initiation of an RCC higher capability program. Now, that program is a long way in developing, and I don't think we'll see anything in significant RCC improvements for either a near-term or intermediate-term time frame. Next chart, please. The wing spar. This requirement in the wing spar was that if you took a quarter-inch or generated a quarter-inch hole with a high-energy debris, the original thought was that you could sustain capability. By analysis and looking at the design, it was discovered that if you have flow-through in that area, there were small zones that could actually create a flow path that would impinge on selected areas of the wing spar connection, and they were exposed. And then also if you took damage to the carrier panels that were right above for accessing the wing spar, you could have a flow path. So in order to cover this area, you put flow restrictors around the panel, the leading edge carrier panel box, redesign the horse collar, which is quite a extensive gap filler. It's an engineering design gap filler around the access panel itself to make sure that you had sleeves at the ends, that if you took some adjacent hits, there were no paths entered there, and then cover any open areas on the wing spar itself with the SIP, which is the material that's used to bond tile, to give it added protection there. The mods are being implemented on 103 and 104 for panels 5, 4, 14, which are the high heating panels. And those are, of the 23 panels, those are being done now. Modification on 105 will be done during the orbiter maintenance mod period. Certification requirement, certification analysis. CAR has been submitted. The parts are at the Cape for the 103 and 104 mods and expected they'll be installed in December. DCR number one is in process now to get the certification approved. This covers the first change. Next chart. Second change is in inspection again as we went and re-examined the thermal barrier design on the main landing gear door. We found that the corners of the main landing gear door, as the barriers come together, there was roughly a 2-inch gap. That if you took a debris hit at the corner of the door, you now had a path to have a direct flow into the main landing gear door. The solution is relatively simple. We restuffed the corners with existing material to make sure that there was no flow path. Engineering has been released for all three orbiters. Mod has been completed on 103 and 104. And the modification will be done on 105 prior to the main landing gear functioning out in the time frame when it goes through its maintenance cycle. Next chart. Forward RCS. There are 10 carrier panels located in the red zones that are that have been attached with bonded on studs instead of mechanically fastened studs. We've lost two during the flights. The concern is obviously they too can become debris or cause other damage. The solution is to replace them with a full, properly riveted stud. Engineering was released for all three orbiters. Mods on 104 and 103 are completed. Certification will be done by analysis and test. The primary test is to ensure we properly characterize the strength of the riveted stud, and that should not be an issue. And the major work to be done is complete the mod on 105 when it goes through its maintenance cycle.
Side question on that is that the only application of bonded on
as far as I know
for carrier panels?
As far as I know. And they were done, I think, originally as MR actions when we finally, the first vehicle's built and was kept through. And now that we went back and looked and found the places where you can really mechanically attach a stud, it could have been done earlier. Okay. As far as I know, I don't think there's any other. Next chart, please. The window, the two side panes, if they took, again, impact damage, they were built with a factor safety of, a margin of safety of 0.5, that's a margin above the 1.4. If they took impact damage because of the narrow margins, they could you'd reduce the margin. The margin's been improved to 0.82 by thickening them up. This... all new, and it's also as you thicken up the panes themselves, then you have to replace the window tiles and redesign those. So all window tile peripherals have been removed. All the new tiles are being installed on 103. 104 is planning is in process, and 105 will be done later. This is being certified by similarity to the current capability, and as far as I know, no unique test will be done. Next chart. The long-term... go ahead.
On that last chart, just a clarification. How does margin of safety relate to factor?
It's, I don't know what's the number, 1 minus... It's 1.4. It's 0.505 above... I don't know what the calculation was. Is it 1.4?
It's either 1.4 or 1.5 for structure.
So 1.4 is the capability, and but I don't know what's the formula. It gives you ability, 1.4... is the
plus
factor safety.
The margin is
Is above the 1.4.
Above the 1.4.
Okay. Above the 1.4.
Okay. That's all right.
Okay.
Thank you for that clarification.
Okay.
The record show.
The long-term work, the next phase work that's been approved, is the outer panels, the four inner panels and the remaining nine outer panels. Will be the protection will be added on those in phase two, and the certification that's being done now will essentially carry the certification there. And then, in the as capability as time permits, they'll be installed on the vehicles. The second long-term change that was approved is the main landing gear barriers. The current design has non-redundant barriers as opposed to what the nose gear system is. The concern there is that if you had an impact and exposed the barrier, you might again open a pathway into the main landing gear doors. The testing that has been done as part of the impact test show that within the current debris definition, it's a highly unlikely event to occur. The change itself is very difficult to implement. It took us a long time to really work out a system of barriers on the nose landing gear door. The doors yourselves are closed and inspected prior to the orbiter going vertical, so you have good assurance there's no inherent leak path. And we have not experienced any real problem with it, but again, analytically, as you examine it, you are concerned that potentially the right kind of debris hit at the right kind of time could expose the system. I think we're going to hear quite a bit more about this design before it gets finished. So although the engineering is scheduled for next year, by the time you go through, you'll improve. There'll be probably a lot of iterations on that design because it just took forever on the nose landing gear door. And those are tough problems. Phase three projects, development of advanced RCC is really in its beginning phase, and full development of the tile projects have been in work for already a couple of years. Implementation has not been done yet, and no one's done the implementation planning. Next chart. We've been working in line with them from witnessing tests, attending debris summits, and overall they've done a tremendous amount of progress in the test side and have much more data than we ever had before. Next chart. Our overall assessment is that the orbiter hardening program itself, the hardware projects, if that were alone, we would be recommending a closeout on that. We think there's adequate progress. The plan makes lots of sense. But since it had coupled together the test and analysis program, which is just really coming to its final stages, the test program and the analysis program seems to make sense. However, we haven't seen the details of how these models will be combined to give the meaningful statistical results and how they're going to be assessed with flight history. Because we have lots of flight history, probably more flight history than we have test history. We want to make sure that the modeling activity doesn't get over-conservative and we understand its significance. And so because of the number and the types of tests done and the newness of the mathematical techniques, we wanted to keep this item open. We have a meeting scheduled as part of the orbital flow in the month of January to help us gain additional insight. If that goes as we'd expect, we should be able to close it out after that. That represents a summary of the orbiter-specific hardening projects.